So, let's move on and look today at three questions. What matters to you? What time is it? What matters to you? What time is it? And do you want to dance with Jesus or not? Okay, they're the three things we're going to look at, three questions from John chapter 4. Well, as you heard it read, we're going to look firstly at three people and see what seems to obsess them at this particular moment of time. The first thing is in verse 27, the woman gets this great moment where Jesus says, I'm the Christ. I'm the long-awaited Messiah. Now, the Samaritans only used the first five books of the Old Testament. One of the distinctives that they had was they only used the books of Moses. And if you want to look up the Samaritans now, because the Samaritans still exist, they still live around Mount Gerizim. There's not many of them. They're an endangered community. And they still only look to Moses as the great prophet. But in Deuteronomy 18, Moses does speak about God sending another prophet. And they were waiting for this other prophet. They tended to use this word, which we would translate as the restorer, whereas the Jews tended to use the word Messiah. But Jesus says, I'm the one. I think the lady would have loved to keep chatting, but on that, unfortunately, some people broke into the conversation and wrecked it, and it was the disciples. Just then, his disciples returned. They were surprised to find him talking with a woman. But no one asked him. No one asked, what do you want? Presumably addressed to the woman. Or, why are you talking with her? Presumably addressed to Jesus. Kind of a shame they didn't. Because it would have helped them and helped her. And she obviously gets the feeling that it's not time to stay anymore, and she leaves. You know, you can sense by the disciples' shock, as we looked at last week, that Jesus is actually talking to a woman. And he's talking, as we know, to a Samaritan woman. And what the disciples didn't know, but Jesus knew, was a woman with a very complex sexual past, living at the time now with a bloke who wasn't a husband. They're surprised. I think it's obvious she picks up the vibe. It's time to go. She leaves her water jar. She's been completely distracted in verse 28. The woman goes back to the town and said to the people, that is the people of the village, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? And they came out of the town and made their way towards Jesus. So we've got the disciples who are surprised that Jesus is doing the wrong thing. He's broken a very clear and deep taboo in that culture, speaking with a woman he didn't know in public. She runs back to town, as I say, having forgotten the reason she went, which was to get the water. She goes back and says, come and see this bloke. She says two things about him. He told me everything I ever did, and they would know something of what that meant. And could he be the Messiah? Could this be the long-awaited restorer? And the way it's worded in the original has the sense of expecting a probable yes to the answer. Anyway, so that's her concern, and the disciples, they're fantastic. They've mission accomplished. They've done what Jesus asked them, and they didn't often get to do that. They'd actually successfully done what Jesus asked him. They'd got the sandwiches, and they were back with the lunch, because at the beginning of the story, Jesus is tired, he's thirsty, and he's hungry. He's a real live human being. They've got the food. That was the expectation of disciples. Part of the relationship that the Jews understood was that the disciples would look after some of the material needs of the rabbi, the teacher. So they're just doing what was expected. They're kind of excited. They've got the sandwich. They've been for a long walk. They've interacted with the Samaritans that they wouldn't have enjoyed much. And they want him to eat. They came back to the town and said, Rabbi, eat something. Jesus said to them, I've got food to eat you know nothing about. Jesus, as usual, being a bit puzzling, his disciples said to each other, could someone have brought him food? Does Jesus have a sort of a secret stash, like some sort of pig who's living in a community, but he's got his own private store of food? Again, you think they probably should have asked him rather than each other. It's much better if disciples ask the teacher, much better if we take our questions to God rather than always taking to each other, but that's what they do, so they continue in ignorance. Jesus then says, verse 34, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. So in the same way as he took the picture of water and played with that in his discussion with the woman, he now takes food and plays with that in his discussion with the disciples. Jesus seems to be almost incapable of speaking in simple, boring, didactic statements. He just is constantly speaking in pictures. You know, our human needs, water. That which keeps you going and moves you forward and drives you on, that's food. And that's how he uses the image, and like the disciples and like Nicodemus before him and like the woman in chapter 4, it takes people a while to get on with what he's saying. The thing that drives Jesus is food. He seems to have finished that conversation with this woman so excited, he's not interested in food. Now, I've met people like that who, when they get excited, are not interested in food. I've never had that experience. I'm always interested in food. Even when I've got food poisoning, I'm interested in food. But there are some people who get so excited by things that they're just not interested in food. It seems that's what's happening for Jesus. He was tired. He was thirsty. He was hungry. He's yet to get a drink. He's spent the whole time chatting with this gal. He hasn't had any food yet, but he seems to be so caught up in what's just happened, this conversation with this thirsty woman, this needy woman. This is the thing that drives him on. And he says, this is what I'm doing, my Father's work. That is the thing that satisfies me. And just so we get the picture, then we'll come back and look at bits of it. Then he talks to them about harvesting. He talks about there's this work to be done. He contradicts the proverb, still 4 months till the harvest. He said, nope, it's harvest time now. They chat about that. Verse 39, the Samaritans come, and the Samaritans spend time with Jesus, 2 whole days with him. So what seems to matter to the disciples is food. They're caught up in the legitimate activity of ordinary physical life. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's absolutely right. But they don't seem to get onto much else apart from food. This happens a number of times. They see the food that Jesus delivers, but sometimes don't get the significance. That happens not only to the disciples, but to the others of his day. The Samaritan woman, on the other hand, she has forgotten her physical needs for the moment, and they are needs, water. And she's all excited about this person she's met, to the point that she goes back and initiates conversation with people who would hate her. But there's something about the way she says it, what she says, the conviction of it, the excitement perhaps, that they listen to her. And they decide they'll go and see what it is that's so excited, this perhaps usually unhappy-looking woman. And what seems to be exciting Jesus is the work of God in the harvest. So these are the three things that are mattering. The disciples always, well, not always, but consistently superficial and distracted by the ordinary from the extraordinary. The woman all excited about Jesus, she's distracted from the ordinary, and Jesus always on about the main game, that is staying in tune and in step with God. And so you've got the disciples here with Jesus, you've got the woman back in the village with the Samaritans. Jesus is talking to the disciples about harvest, but it's critical to see that the conversation he has about the harvest has on both sides of it the Samaritans coming. So at verse 30, they came out of the town and made their way towards him. So that's the, if you had this on a stage, they'd be doing this little caravan of curious Samaritans are walking out to see Jesus. And in the middle of that, before they arrive, Jesus has a conversation about harvesting. And then from 39 to 42, the harvest takes place with the Samaritans. Well, let's have a look at more closely what Jesus talks about, the time and the harvest, which is all happening with the Samaritans coming towards him. Now, I spent about a week of my life in the country and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I know nothing about the country except what I've read and met from boarders when I worked at a school and chatted with them. Really liked the country people, da-da-da-da-da. And one of our wardens at a church I was at was from the country and he was just made of different stuff. I could never work out, is he different because he's a farmer as against a professional biologist? I don't know. But one thing I have learned is that harvest time is a busy time. And you may have seen some of the farmers on the television speak about their massive disappointment, that some of the ones in New South Wales and Victoria, because they were just about to bring in a really, really good harvest. After years of drought, they had a fantastic, top-quality sort of harvest coming in. And this is the pain, I think, for farmers. When people like us in the city are unemployed, that's painful. You know, it's very painful and psychologically very damaging. But for the farmers, it's different. They work and work and work and work and work and get nothing still. Lucky what they do is unimportant because we don't need what farmers produce. We are completely dependent on farmers, right? We just think it comes from shops. But harvest time is the time of joy, even in our farms, when you're actually getting the stuff in. It's actually worked. And in the ancient world, it was marked as a time of eating and drinking and celebration. And the people who reaped, who harvested, it wasn't the grim reaper. We've got that embedded in our brain, the grim reaper. But it was the happy reaper. The sowers were grim. When you sow, you take seed you could eat and you plant it in the ground. It's a high-risk strategy. But when you're reaping, there's nothing grim about that. It's exciting. It's actually worked. You're gonna eat. You're going to have stuff to sell. And Jesus says, we're in harvest time. It's also the time when I know some of the farmers I knew at the school I served at, they would harvest in the fields all day and all night sometimes. They had the lights on the tractors. There was no time to waste. Get out in just in case it rains and destroys it, wrecks it. So Jesus says, the time now is harvest time. And the thing I've been wrestling with much of this week is Jesus' statement in verse 35, which I think is the key statement in this passage. He says, I'm going to do the work of God. That's what feeds me and keeps me going. Look at verse 35. Don't you have a saying, it's still 4 months until harvest? But I tell you, open your eyes and look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest. Even now, those who reap draw their wages. Even now, they harvest the crop for eternal life so the sower and the reaper may be glad together. So Jesus is saying now, some of the scholars try to work out what month was Jesus speaking, because you did the harvesting in March, so maybe it's in January or December or something like that. I mean, who cares, really? But evidently it's not harvest time. Jesus seems to quote a parable that says, a proverb that says, well, you need to, between sowing, you do a bit of tending of the stuff and a bit of worry. And if you're an Easter Islander, you make those big statues. That's apparently when they made the statues, just filling in time, apparently. Between the sowing and the harvesting. But what else can you do? There's no computers, so you make massive, big, handsome faces. But the time of harvest is the time of real sweat and labour and excitement. And Jesus says, it's now! And he's saying, look up, lift up your eyes, see the fields. And literally it says, and it's a shame this is missed in some of the translations, they often, the translations say, like mine does, I tell you, open your eyes, look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest. Literally what Jesus says is they are white for harvest. Now, people just think, particularly scholars living in towers, they think, oh, that might just mean it was ripe. No, because apparently in the Middle East, and I think this is true mostly in Australia, when a crop is ripe, it is not white. It is golden, right? There were no crops that they think the Samaritans grew that were white when they were ready to be harvested. So what is Jesus on about when he says, look, boys, lift up your eyes, it's harvest time, the fields are white for harvest? Well, I'll tell you what I think's happening. The Samaritans wore white. The Samaritans are walking to Jesus. They've obeyed the woman's invitation. Come and see a man who told me everything I've ever done. And they are walking to Jesus. I think what goes with Jesus' statement is, lift up your eyes, look. He points down the road where the Samaritans are coming, perhaps shimmering in the heat, and they're white and ready for harvest. That's what he's talking about. He's not actually saying, boys, you see all those crops that look as if they're undergrown? As a carpenter, I want to let you know they're ready for action. Right? He's always playing with things, isn't he? The water stands for something else. The food stands for something. The harvest. It's not all that hard. Once you get the fact that he's not some guy who uses language in a boring and dull and prosaic way, he's talking about what's happening here. And he says, they're already being harvested. We can talk about what that might... I think it's probably the woman. But that's what Jesus is saying to the disciples. Boys, he says, wake up. It's not a time to be relaxing. It's not nearly time to roll up your sleeves. This is harvest time. But the disciples didn't think it was. They would have thought, boy, and it's one thing, Jesus, to talk to a Samaritan about God, but you've got years of preparation. These guys are so far gone. They're immoral. They stink. They're not nice to us, the people of God. They only have 5 books of the Bible. We've got to introduce them to Isaiah and Judges and all these other books. They need a lot of education before they can be harvested and brought into your kingdom and family. Jesus says, rubbish. It's harvest time, boys. They're white and ready for action. And that's what Jesus is talking about here. And what you have, as you heard in the story, is by the time Jesus leaves, spends 2 days with them, almost the whole village believes that he is the saviour of the world. There's not been a moment like this in the Gospels, and I don't think there's any moment like this actually in the whole of the Gospels, either in Jerusalem or in Galilee or with Capernaum and all these other towns, where it seems the whole town has come to place their faith into Jesus. One of the things that rattled some of the European missionaries when they went to many other cultures is that whole villages became Christians. We thought, no, you can't do that. It has to be one at a time. You all have to be rabid individualists like we are. You can't as a group. When you're suspicious of that, you'll do it the way we do it, or not at all. But it seems that basically this whole village got persuaded. And so what you've got is a massive harvest of Samaritans who were so unready that most of the Jews wouldn't even talk to them about God. So Jesus is saying, understand what time it is. It's harvest time. The disciples need to get, as it were, onto his program and work from his time zone, not their own. And so if Jesus says it's time for harvest, it's time for harvest. And the thing I've been trying to work out is that just a one-off truth for then that John has helpfully recorded for who knows what reason? Or are stories in John like the stories of the Old Testament, which we're told by the Apostle Paul, these things are written for your learning, that by example and encouragement of the Scriptures. My own hunch, having read this and thought about it and talked to some learned people, that there is at least a possible mistake that the current day disciples of Jesus can make, that we can look at people and perhaps even unconsciously judge them and say, oh, no, they're a long way from becoming a Christian, aren't they? I mean, look at the way they live, which is about the least good guide you've ever got to where a person's heart is at in terms of God. Because I know for my own little life, I was getting increasingly, obviously, semi-criminal and destructive at the point when I was getting closer and closer to becoming a Christian. So it caught everyone by surprise. This woman had five husbands, living with a bloke who isn't. She would not seem to be an obvious candidate to become a disciple of Jesus and the first missionary to the Samaritans. But she was. I think the danger here is that we sort of, without meaning to, become judges and say, well, this person isn't ready, so I might just, you know, pray for them rather than say anything about Jesus. Certainly won't ask them to become a Christian. I know certainly I had about six or seven different stories, I won't bore you with them all now, where I've got it completely wrong with people. The most recent one, there was a banker in the city, I won't mention his name, well, I don't think he'd mind, starts to come into the City Bible Forum things and comes to a crash course in Christianity, as we call it, and I thought he had a long, long way to go. I'd spent a lot of time talking, he's very interested in spiritual things, but there was no way I was going to say, buddy, it's about time you decided and prayed. Well, we're at a weekend away with a few of the bankers. We have this little group for bankers so they don't infect anybody else. And they're all, no, it's just kidding. We love bankers. With all the bankers and the financial workers. And I'm sitting at the table. We had this big fancy dinner one night. And then I could hear one of the other guys, who's a sane, well-balanced Christian man, challenging him to become a Christian, telling him he needs to decide, needs to pray, needs to become a Christian. I'm going, oh, man, don't push the guy. Anyhow, there at the dining room table, they bow their heads, they pray, and the guy's happily, excitedly living as a Christian rather than someone looking at it. I thought he was, in my infinite wisdom, I had accidentally judged him as being a long way further. But our brother at this meeting thought otherwise and went for it. When I worked with Chapa for years, I was at Blue Mountains Grammar School, and it was last period, it was year 9. And I had a talk with about the death of Jesus, three crosses and sin being moved from the thief onto Jesus and Jesus going to hell and suffering. And I talked a bit about what hell was like. And it was a good, blunt, brutal talk for year 9. Last period, so I had to be even more energetic. Well, I'd had lunch with some of the staff and some of the music teachers who come in to teach music. And there's this lady there called Claudia. She was a cello teacher. She was everything I'm not. She was cultured. She was thoughtful. She had just been doing world travelling. Her father had just died. We'd had a bit of a philosophical conversation around the table, and apparently her student for last period didn't come in, and she sneaks into the back of the room. And I'm dead set praying that God would get her out of the room. I'm saying, God, get her out of here. This is going to drive her mad. She's a sophisticated, cultured woman. This is for year nine. This is as blunt as I can be, you know. And I'm thinking, oh, no, that's it. She's going to think Christianity is all blood, guts, fire and hell. Anyhow, so just when I finished, she sneaked out. And about 2 weeks later, I got a letter where she'd written to the chaplain, passed it on. That night, she went home and read the Gospels all night and certainly seems to have been born of the Spirit. I'm saying, get out, get out, get out. You're not ready for this. This is not a good talk for you. It's the Gospel, it's true, etc. But, you know, I know better than that. Get out. Right? And God was in the process of renovating her heart. And I wonder if, that's why I do think, I wonder if sometimes we are, with the best intent in the world, liable to say, you know, not yet. This is not your time. This is not harvest time. This is sowing time. Or perhaps even we're way behind sowing. Perhaps we're just going to plough up the fields a bit. Now, it's not saying we shouldn't be sensitive to our friends and try to, you know, work out what might be the next most helpful thing for them to discuss. But I think what Jesus is saying is, forget the idea that you are the reader of human hearts. This is a much bigger topic, but it is one of the great marks, accidental marks of sinful people. You think you know what's going on in other people's hearts. You don't even know what's going on in your own heart. And you have people who'll say to you, no, that's not what you think. I think, hang on. You might be right, but frankly, the ability to read the heart belongs to someone else. Jesus says, it's harvest time, boys. Let's get up and go to work. And he calls them into the work, as he already has, because he's letting them do the baptisms at the beginning of chapter 4. The disciples seem to get the lesson because when they get to Pentecost, right, when the first Christian sermon, so that they're talking to the people who killed Jesus. Now, I would have thought that'd be a good bunch of people not to call to become Christians that night, wouldn't you? They've killed Jesus. Not the most open-hearted people, I wouldn't have thought. But Peter goes all the way through, calls them to repent and to receive forgiveness and times of refreshing from the Lord, etc. When Paul gets to Athens, highly educated, arrogant, know-nothings, again, you'd think, you know, a bit of pre-evangelism maybe, but let's not push it. He goes right to the edge and calls on them to repent, and a few people do. And I wonder sometimes if we don't let people know that a decision needs to be made, that Christianity is not an interesting worldview, although it is, but actually it calls for a change of life and a change of ownership. I think that's often where the hostility comes. People I know, anyhow, are often quite happy to talk about ideas and theology, but if you call on people to change, they'll feel the implication that you are saying, well, it's actually God, that there's actually something not right about the way they're living. And that's when people will sometimes get hostile. The Christians from the 17th century used to say, if you're going to preach repentance, you'd better pledge your head to heaven because you'll probably lose it. Right? They understand that if you ask people to change, which is what the Bible is constantly doing, it may cause trouble. So here Jesus is saying, don't say, oh, sometime down the road. Now, he says. And it's shown by the Samaritans. They turn up, having had a very dodgy little sermon preached to them. Verse 29, it's perfect but dodgy. Come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? She's not even sure. You know, this is hardly a great conviction sermon. She thinks, well, maybe. He's certainly freaky. He certainly spoke to me like no one else has ever spoken. So they get a fairly dodgy preacher. They come up to him in verse 39. They ask him to spend time with them. And to their surprise, perhaps Jesus spends 2 days with them. I would love to, it's a shame we didn't have the video camera on this. I would love to have watched the disciples, all of them good Jewish boys, squirming in the houses of a Samaritan, you know, eating food prepared by Samaritans and watching Jesus at home and relax as he was with tax collectors and sinners and prostitutes, etc. Watching Jesus live out the loving heart of God and the Samaritans themselves squirming a little bit. But by the time you get to verse 42, they're saying, listen, it's not they're being rude about the woman. They're saying, look, we used to think this guy was a somebody because of what the woman said, but now we've met him, and they've gone way past the original Samaritan preacher. They're not saying, maybe this guy could be the Messiah. They're saying, verse 42, they said to the woman, we no longer believe just because of what you said, but now we've heard for ourselves, and we know this man really is the saviour of the world. Right? They really had travelled a huge distance. They had been harvested into the family of God. So what time is it? Jesus is saying is, it's harvest time. Right? Let's pay attention to the main game, Jesus is saying, as he did, as the woman did, and let's know what time it is. And lastly, the question of dancing with Jesus. I often think of various relationships as a form of dance, and often when you tread on each other's toes, you are likely to say, you're an idiot, but it's dancing. And I am an idiot dancer, but I understand in dancing, both people have got to be kind of working together, and it's best to see this as an us problem, not you're a moron problem. That doesn't build the sort of team that you might need in dancing. But so when it comes to working and teaming with Jesus, which is what it is to be a disciple, an apprentice of Jesus, a follower of Jesus, becoming like the Master, it's best, I think, to agree with Jesus about the dance. You're doing a barn dance or some other sort of dance. We're doing a harvest dance, is what Jesus seems to leave the church doing. We're doing a harvest dance in the end. It's about ultimately sharing this wonderful good news of what we have been shown about Jesus with others, like the woman did. And agree that that really, it's hard to find a higher priority in terms of our activities. Right? It's not the only game in town, that's for sure. But I think this passage reminds us in the end that that is what seems to move the heart of Jesus. His love for us means he comes to live and die for us and to call his people to pass that wonderful news on. Now, it's interesting to see who does Jesus dance with and through. Because I think one way to avoid the excitement and the adrenaline of being involved in the harvesting is to think, oh, it's not the time. The other one is to say, I'm not the person. And I think this is more common than we could think. Sometimes Christians will say to you, you're a little too broken. You don't know quite enough. You can ignore them. But more dangerous is the voice inside your own heart that says, you really are not the person to be talking about God. Look at your life, for crying out loud. Not just what it used to be like, but even since you became a Christian, you're a joke. Now, this woman, it's interesting, this gal is the first missionary sent to the Samaritans. So Jesus begins his work of blessing the whole village by blessing this woman with some insiders to him, and she goes, full of fresh excitement, rightly, and she shares. She could well exclude herself, say, I am far too morally questionable to speak on his behalf. Or she could well say, and perhaps we would say, lady, even if you were morally perfect, you're a theological idiot. Don't speak. Come to Bible college, right? Enroll in a few courses, read a few books. She doesn't even yet know that Jesus is the Messiah. She thinks he might perhaps be. Well done, that's good. Right? She's just like a seed just beginning to sprout. There's life there, but you won't get much fruit from it, you wouldn't think. But who does Jesus do his dance with and through? He does it through this woman, which is a great encouragement to people like me. Because I know what a scumbag I am. You don't. I've got a neatly ironed shirt on, right? Except I can kid you that I'm a reasonably decent person. But I know what a scumbag I am. I know what a bundle of contradictions I am. So when I hear that some friend of mine's been speaking with someone and one of their neighbours or workmates has become a Christian, I go, well, of course God will work through someone like that. But every now and then in the jobs I've had, I've heard people say, oh, you know, so-and-so, that person became a Christian when you spoke. I go, yeah, they won't last, right? God's not going to do anything of substance through me, that's for sure. It'll all be as fake as I am, right? But that's all nonsense. The only people God has to work on his team are broken, damaged, incomplete people like me and you. So don't exclude yourself and put yourself on the sideline, because this woman, she so much deserves not even to be on the sideline. She shouldn't be able to cut the oranges. And yet she's in the absolute centre of the game. That's good news, I think. Look at Peter. You know, Jesus says a number of times in the Gospels, if you deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father in heaven. So when Peter says once, twice, three times, although he was warned, I don't know him, I have nothing to do with him, he's gone, baby. He's out the door. He's out there with Judas. In fact, in many ways worse than Judas. And yet, who is the guy that God uses, you know, about a month later to preach the first full Christian sermon? Peter, the three-time loser. Right? It's just not God's way to say, oops, sorry, out of the team. Jonah. I mean, Jonah, you know, he is such a rat. Read Jonah. The reason why he runs away is not because he's frightened of the Ninevites, which is what I was taught at Sunday school, and I've even heard an adult preacher say that. He was frightened that God would be gracious to the Ninevites, and he wanted the Ninevites to burn. They hated the Assyrians, and with good reason. And then when God saves them, he's still angry. He's a grumpy, selfish rat. And yet God uses him to preach the gospel in Nineveh and sees one of the greatest works of the Holy Spirit ever in history. Right? He shouldn't be allowed to play. You go through David, murderer, brutal adulterer. The Apostle Paul, the first murderer of Christians. You, fill in the blank. I don't know what your particular sins are. But the thing it's saying is, God does his dancing with dodgy people. Now, very briefly to finish up, here's the perfect way. You know, if you want to know, boy, I don't know much about Jesus, what can I say to friends? Try verse 29. This is the perfect example. Verse 29. She goes back and says, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? Right? She's got as many questions as answers. She's excited by her interactions with this man. And she says the great words, you pick this up in John's Gospel, chapter 1. The initial invitation that the disciples give is, come and see. Come. In fact, Jesus, his second words in the Gospels are, come and see. This woman's got it perfectly right. She says, this guy's special. I mean, he's unlike anything I've ever seen or expected. Come and have a look for yourself. And she gives a category that she thinks maybe he's the Messiah, the long-awaited restorer that the Samaritans are waiting for. So just try that. Can I suggest if you are a Christian, or even if you're not sure, if you're nearly a Christian, work out what is the thing you find most exciting about Jesus? Right? What is the thing you find most wonderful that caused you the most happiness about Jesus, about knowing him? And just learn how to express that in simple English. And say that. Right? I think Jesus is great because this. Come and have a look. Come and see. That's what the Samaritans do. They go and see. They spend 2 days with him. He doesn't even do any miracles, we're told, just on the basis of listening to him. I'd have loved to hear what he said to them. Right? They just hear him speak to them for 2 days. But her invitation is perfect. Come and see. Read a gospel. Would you like me to read a gospel with you? It's very good for Christians to have in their handbag or briefcase a couple of copies of John's Gospel or Mark's Gospel. It's a gift to people. I love to ask people in the city, have you had a chance since you became an adult to read one of the 4 biographies of Jesus? Answer, without exception so far, I've only been asking it for a year, without exception, unless they're keen Christians, the answer has been no. And most people have got enough integrity to think, that's ridiculous, isn't it? To have never read one of the biographies of Jesus. So to have one, you know, just to buy one, there's a number of bookshops you can get them from. And just to say to people, come and see. Tell people what you find exciting about Jesus and invite them to come and have a look for themselves. That's the perfect technique. Well, I do need to finish up because we've got the Lord's Supper to enjoy together. Let me give you one other example that you may have. I want to give you some homework. That is, if you've got the internet at home, go into YouTube and type in these words, Son of Hamas. And then you'll find a series of things will come up about the son of Hamas. And then particularly if you look at Fox. Now, I know for some of you this will be a new experience to look at a Fox program, completely balanced news. But they do a longish interview with him over about 6 10-minute things. But you can read shorter ones, so I hear him speak. It's a terrifically... This guy, his father was one of the founding fathers of Hamas, a fairly violent independence movement, etc. This young man loves his father, still does, although he knows he's broken his father's heart. Went to prison as a member of Hamas. As he got up close to the movement and some of the aspects of it, he fell into tremendous despair about Islam, although his father was an imam, etc. He was released. He was walking through Jerusalem, and someone who did not know who he was, or I'll bet they wouldn't have talked to him if they knew that he was a gentle terrorist and very close to this movement. A tourist outside one of the gates of Jerusalem said, would you like to meet with the group of us who are reading the Bible together? He says, yes. I really do think if the American tourist who asked that question had known who he was, he would not have been invited to read the Bible. Right? There's a very dangerous man. He reads the first thing they looked at was where Jesus says, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, pray for those who mistreat you. And that God spoke to him, and he just knew, this is a teaching the likes of which I've never heard anything like. And this is the only answer to our broken world. It took him a year or so to become a Christian, but I think, again, if we'd have known who he was, he probably wouldn't have been invited. This chapter is about mission. It's about the loving heart of God to bring water to the thirsty, to bring forgiveness to the guilty, to take a broken life like this woman and love her and renew her and restore her, and then within seconds give her the extraordinary privilege of dancing with Jesus in saving her whole village. The passage, I take it, is recorded for us to learn a number of things, one of which is to stay involved in whatever way we can with this great mission of Jesus, to pass on the love that he has for others, to meet their deepest needs, and to not sort of exclude ourselves, or like the disciples, get too excited about bread and sandwiches.